I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, we'll check in on hearings on the Hill, including actor Dennis Quaid testifying before Congress on medical mix-ups after a hospital gave his newborn twins a near-fatal overdose. But first, according to Consumer Reports magazine, Americans are giving themselves overdoses and mixing up medications at an alarming rate because they aren't asking pharmacists about drug interactions. The magazine also found that last year, Americans spent $287 billion on prescription drugs alone, and the cost of the same drug varies wildly, sometimes by a couple hundred dollars. So we'll start today with a conversation about drugs and drugstores with Todd Marks, senior editor of Consumer Reports. Welcome.
Good day. How are you?
I'm just fine. Let's get to your findings, though, because they're just really amazing. Let's talk about the wide swing in the cost of drugs. Give me an example.
What we did was a national price study of four relatively common drugs: Plavix, Levoxyl, Detrol, and Alendronate. And what we did is we placed 500 calls to 163 different drugstores to get price quotes. And we called all sorts of pharmacies from coast to coast. We contacted online pharmacies. We contacted the big drug chains like, Rite Aid and Walgreens. We went to supermarket pharmacies such as Publix and Hannaford. We visited independents. And we went to the mass merchandise or big box store pharmacies, Walmart, Kmart, Shopko. And what we came away with was the basic point of reference that drug prices can vary significantly depending upon where you shop. Our market basket of four drugs, for example, the average price for those four prescription drugs we priced out at Costco was $962. Compare that to Rite Aid, which was the most expensive source we contacted for our market basket, $1,302. That's quite a swing. But not only that, what we found really startling was the difference in prices for the same prescription medicine within the same drugstore chain or same drugstore family.
Right.
For example, let's look at Costco. Costco did very well in this particular price study. They were a very good low-cost source of the medicines we were looking for. But their prices for Plavix, for example, differed from, at one store, from $382 to another store, $421.
Hmm.
Now, that's about a $40 swing. That's not too bad. But let's take a look at something that was way more dramatic. At Shopko, which is a big box discounter in the Midwest, the price we were quoted for Plavix, which is a medication to prevent blood clots, was anywhere from $407 for a 90-day supply to $541 for a 90-day supply. Now, that's a tremendous swing. And if you're paying out of pocket, and unfortunately, our survey shows that more and more people are having to dig deeper in their pockets to pay for their prescription drugs, you really learn the lesson that it does pay to shop around and get more than one quote.
So this cost comparison, and as you just said, Americans are spending more. But you're talking about the box stores and, you know, saying that Costco had some good prices. But the magazine goes on to say, don't rule out independents, that the independent stores offer something more. What do they offer?
Well, the great thing about independents, and we've been surveying our readers about drugstores and their prescription drug buying experiences for a decade now. And every time we do this wide-scale survey, we find that the independents come out well above the rest. And a matter of fact, for overall satisfaction with the prescription drug buying experience, and what we're talking about there is really people's experiences buying prescription drugs. Did they have to wait at the pharmacy? Was the pharmacist accessible? Were they helpful? Were they knowledgeable? You know, did they have the prescription medicine they needed at the time they needed it? Was it delivered on time? Did they have to wait a couple of days? Those are all the factors that play into our ratings of drugstore chains. And the independents, time and again, have come out on top. People really do love them when it comes to service, knowledgeable pharmacists, speed of service, and having medicines in stock. And this time, it was no different than previous surveys. The independent drugstores were superb as a group. Now, that's not to say every independent in the world is great, because obviously they're independent businesses answerable only to themselves. But we always tell folks, if you have the opportunity to buy at an independent drugstore in your area, take advantage of it, because, again, the service and the satisfaction on average is very, very high among our readers, and that has not changed for many years.
Even if the price of the prescription drugs is a little bit higher.
That's an interesting thing because, you know, you would think that the mom-and-pop type store would charge a lot more. And you know what? In many instances, the independents were, in fact, more expensive. But in our nationwide price study, what we found is that there were many independents that were very competitive on price. You should ask if you have an independent druggist in your area that you want to go to, tell them you want to shop locally. Tell them that, you know, if you can match or come close to the price that you'd pay at a neighboring chain or a competitive chain, say, I'd like to give you my business. Is there any way you can work with me? It never hurts to ask. Because remember, what we're finding out is that people are paying more and more out of pocket, whether that means they're paying a higher percentage of their drug bills or whether their copays are higher, we can't exactly determine. But the fact is they're having to dig deeper. But still, insurance is probably paying for most of it. And if that's the case and you have the opportunity to go to an independent, then grab it. Because in that case, price doesn't become a significant linchpin, and it's worth trying to go to an independent because of all the advantages that they offer.
And one of them is that you would get to know your local pharmacist, and I raise that because of a really disturbing statistic that you provide here in the article, that fewer and fewer Americans are asking their pharmacist about drug interactions, even while Americans are taking more and more drugs.
This is one of the key findings we learned in this particular survey. The fact is, readers sought advice about prescription drugs at just 38% of the pharmacies they visited during the course of a year. And they asked about over-the-counter remedies only 29%. This is relatively low. When we did our survey in 2002, the figures were 50% and 37% respectively. The bottom line here is that fewer folks are asking their druggists about potential interactions regarding either prescription or over-the-counter remedies. This is serious. The bottom line, they're not having a lot of contact with their pharmacist.
It's very serious. Yeah. You give a number from the Institute for Safe Medication Practices. It's a nonprofit. They estimate that 18 million people go to an emergency room every year because they've taken their medication incorrectly.
With more people taking more medication, becoming more reliant on medication, and taking more vitamins, minerals, supplements, you name it, the fact is these things are not innocent products. Taken incorrectly or taken with prescription medicines that may in fact not work well together, you could have serious interactions or complications. So it's very important that you discuss with your druggist everything that you're taking, prescription or otherwise, because the potential is significant. And we try to find out why is it that people seem to be contacting their druggist less. And we don't have a clear-cut answer, but chances are people are relying more on the internet for a lot of the information they seek on their prescription drugs and their over-the-counter remedies, or in fact, maybe they're purchasing more drugs online. More and more people are getting their prescription medicines through what they call PBMs or pharmacy benefit managers. Those are companies that administer drug plans for employers. And even though people were very satisfied with them, they offer 24/7 consultations and you can contact them. I think when people sometimes don't go face-to-face with somebody, that they're less inclined to ask questions.
Well, you mentioned the PBMs, the pharmacy benefit managers. Mm-hmm. A colleague of ours here takes a medication. Her costs went from $20 for a one-month supply of this medication to $20 for a three-month supply. Mm-hmm. I mean, a real mm-hmm. drop in the cost. And you can find out about them, I guess, by asking your employer if one's available. So they do offer some benefits. Mm-hmm.
Well, they offer a lot of benefits. If you're on a chronic care medication, these can be a tremendous boon because, again, they can give you economies of scale. If you buy drugs that are within your formulary, and a formulary is nothing more than a brochure, if you will, of preferred medications. That is, the PBMs are so large. I mean, you can't underestimate the size of these major, major corporations. They're often publicly traded companies with, doling out hundreds of millions of prescriptions a year. These are big, big players. They have tremendous clout with drug makers, and they can negotiate very good discounts on the purchase of particular drugs. So if you buy drugs that are preferred and they can get a deal on those drugs, that deal will be passed along to you. But I think there's one other thing that you mentioned, you touched on, that I think the PBMs have been instrumental in helping foment. That is the notion of the 30-day prescription supply. There was a time where you could only get a 30-day supply of your prescription drugs at a brick-and-mortar walk-in pharmacy. But the fact is today you can get that 90-day supply at a regular, you know, chain drugstore, supermarket pharmacy, discount store pharmacy, and the like. So you ask your doctor if you could possibly get a 3-month supply through your regular prescription plan. Don't have to belong to a PBM, because that could save you time. You may not save as much money. You may have to pay those 3 copays, but you'll get your medicine in one fell swoop, and that offers a sense of convenience that you don't have to reorder all the time.
By the way, we've mentioned online sites, and you write, if you're unfamiliar with a site, you can check to see if it's licensed in your state. I mean, how do you know whether the drugs you order online are good?
Well, you need to deal with reputable pharmacies. This is the key thing. The major drugstore chains, whether it's Rite Aid, Eckerd, Logs, Walgreens, CVS, Brooks, Jewel Osco, Snyder's, Medicine Shop, these are some of the big names that we have in our survey, they're reputable, and their online arms are reputable. The same thing with a supermarket pharmacy or mass merchandise store pharmacy. The problem you get is when you're dealing with unknown entities. Companies we think are from Canada. And why do I say we think? Because remember, a few years ago, there was a tremendous, tremendous interest in medications purchased from Canada. And that whole issue has died down a lot. And I'll tell you one of the key reasons why. It's because of Medicare Part D. Who are the folks that were going to Canada or trying to go online to contact so-called Canadian pharmacies for prescription medicines? Mostly it was senior citizens or those who, weren't covered by an employer's plan. Because of the reputation Canada had, rightly or wrongly, in many instances it was correct, that prescription drug costs were lower. Well, the fact is, when Medicare Part D came into being a few years back, the incentive to go to Canada to purchase these medications was no longer there.
Because the U.S. government won't factor Canadian purchases into the Part D deductive. That's a big thing.
You can't add in, if you're paying a deductible through Medicare Part D and you buy your medications in Canada, fact is that the government won't recognize that. So, it's kind of nil. And again, the fact is people are getting their medications through other means now. And so that whole issue with Canada has died down. But again, I think there are a lot of options to folks that are well known, that will offer discounts if that's important to you, and that are credible. Pharmacies that have a lot of integrity, that have a good track record. So I would always advise people not to deal with the unknown.
And by the way, there are ways to check state licensing of online sites. You can go to our website, here-now.org, for the whole article. Another finding, by the way, from Consumer Reports, Americans are popping over-the-counter pills, Aleve, Buffering, without reading fine print. We'll be back with more from Todd in a minute, Here and Now. In a couple of minutes, hearings on the Hill about drug packaging, but we're talking with Todd Marks first. He's senior editor at Consumer Reports magazine about drug purchasing. And Todd, I want to talk about generic drugs. I mean, you make a big point of saying buy generic. Generic drugs cost 20 to 50% less than brand names. But, okay, I'm an example. I know my allergy medication is exactly the same as the generic, and I do not buy it. What is up with that?
You've been brainwashed. The fact of the matter is, it's not like comparing your store brand cereal to the national brand. The FDA actually tests these products, and they have to be just as effective. If you have the same active ingredient in an over-the-counter remedy as you have in its national brand counterpart, it has to be just as effective. Maybe the box isn't as pretty, and maybe they don't do as much advertising, so the thought of it isn't uppermost in your mind.
I think that's it.
It's all psychological.
Yeah, it's the fear that, I need it so desperately for my allergies, I can't afford for it not to work. But you're saying,
sure,
if the ingredients are the same, then it's got to be the same. Speaking of which, I just My pharmacist at a local pharmacy recently pointed out that a medication that used to require a prescription is now over the counter. Mm-hmm. It's Zaditor. It's an eye drop for allergies. They said mm-hmm. it cost about $190 when it was prescription, and now it costs $16. Mm-hmm. It's about an inch high. How mm-hmm. can the drop in price be that much?
When a particular prescription drug is within the purview or the domain of its one and only manufacturer, that's the time that drug manufacturers seek to make their money. They've invested a lot of time, sometimes years and years and years, in getting this drug through the FDA approval process, which is not easy. Then you've also got to take into account the failures of other drugs that they've tried to get on market that perhaps didn't make it there. This is all part of company expenses. So when they get the blockbuster drug, this is the time they have to make their money back. Beyond that, when a product is available, prescription only, they're realizing that most of that drug's cost is going to be picked up by an insurance company, not the individual. Now, the minute this product goes generic or can be manufactured by multiple manufacturers, it's no longer an exclusive copyrighted product, well, that's when, you know, it becomes much cheaper. Now, it may not be dirt cheap, but the fact of the matter is there aren't a lot of people going to go to a pharmacy and pick up that particular medication you mentioned and dig deeply into their pockets for $200 to buy it. I dare say there won't be many at all. So what it does at that point, it becomes a much, much less expensive product available to the masses where they do a more volume business, and you can get it at a more affordable rate because, again, there's competition. You won't have to buy it exclusively through a manufacturer, and there's no insurance. Remember, when insurance pays for something, people are less price sensitive.
Todd Marks, thank you so much. Todd Marks of Consumer Reports Magazine. And again, for more, go to our website, here-now.org. We'll link you up. Well, let's touch down now in Congress, where there were hearings today, one on another aspect of drug safety, at issue a move by the Bush administration to further limit Americans' abilities to sue drug makers. Actor Dennis Quaid testified. Now, his newborn twins were given a near-fatal overdose of the drug heparin. Quaid says the drug maker Baxter Healthcare Corp. New bottle labels were not clearly labeled.
A federal ban on lawsuits against drug companies would not just deny victims compensation for the harm that has been done to them. It would also relieve drug companies of the responsibility to make drugs as safe as they can be, and moreover, to correct problems after that drug has been on the market.
Joe Williams of the Washington, D.C. Bureau of the Boston Globe joins us. Joe, we rush to say Quaid's twins are fine now. But he is saying, and others are agreeing, that Baxter knew those bottles were not clearly labeled. In fact, they're making clearer labels on the new bottles that are being produced, and therefore Baxter should be held responsible. But because of federal laws, Baxter can't be held responsible.
That's correct. It's all part of a push to help protect drug manufacturers from lawsuits, which has been a part of the conservative agenda for years. And the Quaid situation, while unfortunate, has become one of the bright lights on where that distinction is now being contended.
Well, and just remind us, how alike were these two bottles, one for adults, one for children?
The bottles were the same color, the labels were not indistinct, and the habits of some healthcare providers in storing the bottles had them turned a certain way where at first glance or at a quick glance, in an urgent situation or in an emergency or sometimes just out of simple carelessness, it's hard to tell one from the other.
Well, and of course, drug companies are saying that if they are, you know, sued in many cases, they can't afford to produce medications. And they're also saying that the FDA has approved them, so that should remove any liability?
That's correct. Because these drugs were on the market and were approved by the FDA, headed to pharmacy shelves and hospital shelves as is, and the FDA gave it the big thumbs up, that's all the government oversight regulation that was necessary, and that indicated that the government thought it was safe enough to put on the shelves. Therefore, it should not necessarily absolve from liability, but certainly reduces it in the case of any kind of accidents or any problems that should develop once the drug is on the market.
What's your sense of what's going to happen here?
It's going to be another sort of battleground between Congress and the White House. The conservative agenda and President Bush's agenda has been to sort of protect companies from these lawsuit liabilities. Congress, on the other hand, since the Democrats have taken control, are more interested in pushing back that boundary. But a lot of it has been waged through regulation, through agencies, and not necessarily out in public in front of legislators and where people can get a good, honest, open look at it. It's been sort of an agenda by management of agency rather than one that's been necessarily as public as this will make it.
And Joe, just one really quick question. Farm bill up against today, will it be pushed down the road again?
It'll get kicked down the road. It seems like Congress will probably go for it, but the president will say no, and then they'll have some real decisions to make.
Down the road. Joe Williams from the Washington, D.C. Bureau of the Boston Globe. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay, still ahead. Are Minnesotans taking Al Franken's run for the Senate seriously? That's after the news, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now.
Al Franken, why don't you run for president? Well, I'd like to be president. I think I'd be a great one, perhaps one of the greatest in our nation's history. But I don't want to submit myself to the intrusive scrutiny characteristic of today's presidential politics. For example, I'd have to give up adultery.
Al Franken kept that promise he made on Saturday Night Live. He's not running for president. He's running for senator. He's campaigning to be the Democratic candidate to challenge Republican Norm Coleman for the seat once held by Paul Wellstone in Minnesota, the state that once elected the wrestler Jesse Ventura governor. Joshua Green is senior editor at The Atlantic. He profiled Franken's race in the May issue. Joshua, the headline is, he's not joking. You write, Franken is running a serious campaign, but doesn't he have to fight the perception that this is a joke?
Well, I think the biggest challenge when you're running with an unorthodox background is to convince people that you're qualified for the Senate. And because Franken has had such a long and high profile and at times controversial comedy career, I think he's had sort of an extra high hurdle to clear in convincing people that he has the material to be a U.S. senator. And he spent a lot of the last year touring through small towns all over Minnesota, doing all the political events, the bean feeds, the spaghetti dinner, to convince people. I think he has convinced a lot of Democrats that he's the best guy to be the senator in the fall.
Well, and he has a particularly high hurdle, given that he wrote the book on a fake presidential candidacy. He wrote the novel Why Not Me, and in it, he, the candidate, is running on a platform of lowering ATM fees.
Eliminating ATM fees, not just lowering
getting rid of
so,
that.
Yeah, so he's already been sort of through the comedy version of this campaign in his book. You know, he really is a guy who cares a lot about policy, who knows a lot about the issues, and I think he saw an opening for himself and decided it may not seem like it to other people, but this is the next logical step in my career, and I'm going to do this.
Here's why he says he is running.
I'm running for that kid in Mankato who sells his plasma to pay for college, for the grandmother in intensive care because she couldn't afford medicine, and for the people who tell me the cost of health care is ripping apart their lives. I'm running for families.
That's one of Al Franken's campaign ads, and one of his issues is lowering the cost of health care. But what about his stand on the war? He has said he would have voted for the invasion of Iraq in 2002, even though he's against it now.
Franken, I think, is a little bit embarrassed by the fact that he did support the war and has had to bend over backwards in the Democratic primary to explain that fact and to apologize for it to Minnesota's Democratic voters.
You say Franken is the favorite to be the Democratic nominee to challenge Republican Norm Coleman in November, but there's at least one other serious Democratic challenger, a college professor named Jack Nelson Pallmeyer. He has a long history of political activism in Minnesota. He's a very respected figure there, also very much against the war, and he says he's closing the gap on Franken. Here's Nelson Pallmeyer on Minnesota Public Radio this week.
We talk about the Iraq War in ways that connect with people's lives. That's why I'm constantly reminding people, you know, one day of Iraq war spending, we could hire 9,300 teachers for a year. So people are making that connection between the cost of the war and unmet needs at home.
Let's talk about Norm Coleman, the Republican. He's just, we understand, sent a letter out to Minnesotans accusing Al Franken of flip-flopping, changing positions to not appear as liberal as he really is. Coleman says Franken has stopped cursing in public. We know that he frequently sprinkled four-letter words throughout his books and in his terminology, and Coleman saying Franken's pulling back on that. But we understand the Franken people are accusing Coleman of hypocrisy in that accusation. How so?
It's a little tough for Norm Coleman to accuse anyone of flip-flopping, since Coleman himself was a former Democrat who flip-flopped and is now a Republican senator from Minnesota. And the real irony, it seems to me, is that Franken's major change of position has been on the Iraq War, and he's gone from being for it at the outset to very much against it now. So if anything, he sort of flopped in a more liberal direction. The bigger challenge that he's going to face is Coleman's accusation on use of four-letter words and all the kind of outrageous antics and humor, which is still, it's still very much an open question of whether or not that's going to be a serious political liability for Franken. And Coleman would very much like to make it one.
Well, you add to that, you know, he's trying to reach out to the middle, and he's the guy who, I think, tackled a heckler of Howard Dean. He also had a very public fight with Bill O'Reilly and, of course, his book about Rush Limbaugh. He goes out on limbs, and, you know, is the middle in Minnesota going to appreciate that?
One of the concerns about Franken among Democrats in Washington is that he won't be able to kind of keep his cool and maintain his composure in a political arena, which as we all know, is a lot different than comedy, where, you know, flying off the handle can often be very funny, and Franken happened to be very good at that. So one of the challenges that Franken has got to face is to be able to kind of maintain his composure when he's picked on and criticized by his Republican rivals.
He's also been criticized for some tax issues. He apparently failed to pay income taxes in many states. He's, of course, a traveling stand-up comic at one time. He says it was his accountant who reported the income elsewhere. He's actually overpaid taxes in other states. He's going to say he's going to pay the, what was it, $50,000 to $70,000 in back taxes to various states. You know, is this kind of thing that sort of might reek to a Minnesotan of a, you know, Hollywood by way of Minneapolis kind of character? Is that gonna hurt him?
I think where it hurts him is it suggests, you know, maybe this guy isn't quite up to the task of being senator. I think it helps feed a little bit of the doubts that people naturally have about someone with such an unorthodox political background. And I think it also points to the fact that Franken is a rookie.
On the other hand, his supporters point to the thing that you write much about, which is that Al Franken is a politics wonk. You know, it's something he's embraced for a long time. He's not coming to the table late on this. And he has an emotional connection to the seat he's running for. It was held by his dear friend Paul Wellstone, who we remember was killed in a plane crash right before the 2002 elections, who's an icon. And he can stand in Wellstone's shadow better than maybe some others.
Franken has a fairly long history in Minnesota of campaigning on behalf of Democratic candidates. And he first began this, I think, in 89 and 90 when Paul Wellstone first ran for the Senate seat. Franken was out campaigning for him. And over the years, they developed a very, very close friendship. So there's something very personal to Franken, I think, about winning back, he'd call it Wellstone's seat. And I think it's also poignant in the sense that if you look at what kind of a senator Al Franken might be, the best guess I can make is that if he makes it to the Senate, he'll probably inherit very much the same role that Paul Wellstone did. Wellstone, even when he wasn't going to win on an issue, never hesitated to kind of go out and make impassioned speeches on behalf of the little guy. That seems very likely to be the role that Al Franken would play in the Senate too, I think.
Well, and Al Franken has one last advantage if he were to win. Of all the freshman senators, he's probably been in Iraq the most.
Long before it became fashionable among Democrats, long before September 11th, Franken would travel overseas on USO tours. He's been to Bosnia, to Iraq, to Afghanistan, entertaining the troops. So this is obviously something that was near and dear to his heart long before he really started thinking about a political career.
Joshua Green, senior editor at The Atlantic. Josh, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's always good to be with you.
Quick note now about some of the stories in the works here at Here and Now. How much money can you save on gas if you avoid idling at left-hand turns? Well, enough that UPS has practically banned them for its drivers. We'll find out why. Also, the controversy around the Martin Luther King Memorial. And before we go today, poet Nikki Giovanni, you're listening to Here and Now. Well, it's official. Aliens and Catholics are not at odds. The Vatican's chief astronomer says, just as we consider earthly creatures as a brother and sister, why should we not talk about an extraterrestrial brother? It would still be part of creation. The church pronouncement comes as there is more for Catholics and everyone to consider. Today, the British National Archive released more than 1,000 pages of classified documents about UFO sightings in the UK in the late 70s and early 80s. David Clark is a British UFO expert with a PhD in English cultural tradition and folklore. He's been working with the British Archive on this release. Dr. Clark, we haven't heard any breathless bulletins that the papers say, yes, there is proof there are aliens out there. So what is in these documents?
There's no smoking gun, I suppose you could say. I mean, but there is lots and lots of evidence of very, very puzzling things that have been seen by, you know, very credible witnesses. There are some very bizarre stories from people who claim that they've been in psychic contact with aliens, this kind of thing. But there are also some very, very serious reports made by military personnel, including radar operators, aircrew pilots. Now, there's nothing in there that you could say is proof that we are being visited by aliens, but there's certainly evidence that there's something going on that deserves a more detailed study than what it's received in the past.
Give us a brief example of one of the more credible reports.
There was a report from a crew of a Royal Navy Sea King helicopter that was on a flight over the Bristol Channel, and they detected on their airborne radar two unidentified objects that were travelling some fantastic speed. And they tracked these things for about 40 miles. They had them on the radar. They couldn't see anything visually, but they were absolutely certain in the report they submitted to the Ministry of Defence that this wasn't some kind of mistake, it wasn't some atmospheric anomaly or some quirk of the weather. And in a lot of cases, people such as military personnel, they're literally putting their careers on the line by making an official report like that. So I think when you do see a report like that, you need to take it seriously.
There's one that we read about on the Newswire from stone-sober air traffic controllers who swear they saw a circular vehicle touch down on their runway and take off. And this is several people at one time saw it.
That's right, yeah. And they were very senior air traffic controllers. And again, they submitted this report to the Ministry of Defense, and they said, please, you know, do not release our names because we fear that it will look bad on our reputations.
And we understand British officials investigated these sightings to the point where they could prove that they weren't enemy aircraft. This was largely during the Cold War. Once they proved it wasn't enemy aircraft, they didn't go on to try to prove what they were.
It's very frustrating, isn't it? I mean, for people who are interested in this from a scientific point of view, it's a real shame that it was the military that were receiving these reports. They basically applied a very strict defense policy that they would look at these reports that they received only to eliminate the possibility that any of these UFOs could be enemy aircraft. And again, we look at that in hindsight and we think, well, why not? You know, why weren't these reports passed to scientists? But, you know, there was no requirement for them to do so.
Yeah, and you say that that's part of the problem. We ask the wrong question. We ask, do you believe in UFOs? Well, you know, you have to believe. Here you have thousands of documents of unidentified flying objects. You say the question has to be, do you believe that UFOs are alien spaceships?
I don't think it's possible to prove that. I think all you can do, really, is just eliminate the possibilities, and you're then left with a smaller and smaller number of things that these things could be. But my personal view is that what we're dealing with is some kind of natural phenomena, some kind of very, very rare phenomena that appears in our atmosphere from time to time. You've heard of ball lightning, very rare. People who've seen it.
Ball lightning?
Ball lightning.
Instead of like a zigzag, it's in a ball of light?
Yeah, like a globe of light that's associated with thunderstorms. And scientists do not understand how these lightning balls are formed. They're just as puzzled by ball lightning as they are with lots of other natural phenomena. I think that hidden away in some of these cases, the inexplicable ones, we're not dealing here with alien visitations. We're dealing with some kind of unknown, unclassified natural phenomenon that appears on this planet that isn't coming from anywhere else.
Well, now some of these are in the hands of scientists, so be interesting to see what further you come up with. That's Dr. David Clark, a UFO expert in Britain, speaking about the release today of thousands of pages of previously classified documents of UFO sightings in Britain. Dr. David Clark, as they say on The X-Files, the truth is out there.
Yes, certainly is.
Next up, the grasshopper and the ant go to court in 1 minute, here and now. Poet and Virginia Tech professor Nikki Giovanni's latest book was a long time coming and for good reason. In 2005, her mother and her older sister died within months of each other. Her illustrator, Chris Rashka, lost his father. Then, of course, came the 2007 campus shootings by her former student. Giovanni wrote the poem, We Are Virginia Tech. It was read at the school's memorial service. But this week, at long last, comes Giovanni's new children's book, The Grasshopper's Song and Aesop's Fable Revisited, and it's a delight. We've all heard Aesop's fable of the grasshopper and the ant. The ant toils while the grasshopper plays, the grasshopper laughing at the ant for being such a fuddy-duddy. Then winter comes, the grasshopper has no food. The moral being, playing is bad, working is good. But what if the grasshopper was playing a violin, and that helped the ant do his work, increased production? What then? In Giovanni's story, Jimmy Grasshopper is an artist who wants to take his labor dispute with the ants to court, so he goes to his lawyer, Henry the Robin.
Jimmy Grasshopper was furious. All summer long, I sang for them. All summer, I gave them the beat by which they harvested their food. Even in the evening, when we were all tired, I played a melody to keep up our spirits. I never thought they would turn their backs on me. It's just not right. Henry Sr. adjusted his glasses. Did they ask you to sing? Well, no, but they enjoyed my music. I'm not sure how we should proceed, Jimmy. You provided a service they didn't request. That's true, but they used it. They accepted my offer by letting me work alongside them every day. Will you take my case? Will you sue the ants for me? And what will we sue them for? Asked Henry Sr. Respect, said Jimmy Grasshopper. R-E-S-P-E-C-T.
That's Nikki Giovanni reading from The Grasshopper's Song. We spoke with her recently. She told us she's put the Virginia Tech shooting behind her. She's proud of the university, but they're all moving on. Well, we did too. We asked her what inspired her to reinterpret Aesop's fable.
I was always disturbed about it. My grandfather used to read Aesop's fables to us, and it was the one that really just disturbed me because it seems that the ants were so mean-spirited. And I thought, in the winter, how could you turn somebody away like that? For example, I went to Sunday school. Every Sunday you'd go to Sunday school,
right.
And then grandmother and grandpapa would come to church, and you'd do that, and then you'd go home, change clothes, and then grandmother would invariably give my sister and me a plate and say, take this to, you know, Mrs. Black, take this to Sister Smith, and we'd have to deliver food to the sick and shut in. And I just wasn't used to people being mean-spirited. And I thought, something's wrong with this.
Well, on the other hand, Jimmy the Grasshopper, could he have been seen as a little bit of a freeloader?
Oh, no, no. He's an artist. You're telling me Michelangelo is a freeloader, that Beethoven is a freeloader, that Shakespeare is a freeloader? They're artists, and they make our lives all the more richer. We're all working for a better life.
And you have said you, Nikki Giovanni, are a grasshopper.
I definitely am a grasshopper, yeah.
Well, as your story unfolds, we soon have law and order playing out in the meadow. Judge Oscar Owl calls the jury before they can go to their summer homes. I love it. And you have this whole host of creatures beautifully drawn by artist Chris Rashka.
Yeah.
What do the ants say in their defense?
The ants said that there was no contract. They don't deny that Jimmy's music has helped them with their cadence and helps them bring in their harvest. But what they said was, we didn't ask him to do it. We, in fact, suggested that he do traditional work. But if we did traditional work, there would be no beauty. And that's going to be Jimmy's position, that the work that I did is the work of the heart and the soul.
Let's go to page 31, where he makes his impassioned appeal when he gets to the stand. What are some of the things that he says about the worthiness of his work?
Well, Jimmy is the plaintiff, and I wanted the kids to understand that. So as the plaintiff, he goes first. Am I not worthy of my bread? Does not the work of my heart and soul earn respect? I'm an artist. Is there no place for beauty, no solace for the ear, no hope for the heart? Must everything be in the marketplace? Doesn't the marketplace itself need and deserve beautification? Artists tell the stories that entertain and instruct. We tell the jokes that make you laugh, thereby keeping you healthy and happy. We describe the beauty of nature in ways that can make you weep with awe at the marvels of a higher power. Without art, life would be a big mistake.
Sounds
and
good.
And I think that he's making a point. Yeah.
But on the other hand, let me play, well, the lead attorney for the ants and say, wait a minute, isn't this perpetrating the welfare state? Rather than demand half of the ants' summer earnings, which is what Jimmy Grasshopper is looking for, shouldn't he negotiate for a contract and a salary? Make it a job.
No. And I've got to point out, Jimmy didn't say that. Jimmy just wanted respect. And Harry Robin of Robin, 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 and Wren said, we cannot demand respect, but we can get you half the harvest. Because he also knew that half the harvest would be a job. That the ants, if they lose this case, and we're not going to go through appeals, but if they lose this case, Jimmy will have earned the respect and a job. Because now they know next summer, if Jimmy comes, if they let him sing while they work,
it is a job. Right.
And it's a happier situation. If Jimmy prevails, if the ants prevail, then we've gotten back to a them that's got can get and them that's not, you know, shall want.
Well, we won't give away the ending here.
No.
But I do want to say you mentioned Jimmy Grasshopper's law firm, Robin, 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 and Wren.
Right.
On the other side for the ants, you've got moth, moth, butterfly, and slug.
Now, yeah, I'll sell a slug. Yeah.
Kind of loads it, doesn't it?
Well, she can turn into a butterfly. You know, she can work on it. You know, we're not condemning her. And moths come out at night. Moths are quite beautiful, actually. But I thought we had to throw that slug in. But they have a chance to evolve, too. And they make a good case. They're going to ask questions like, you know, who asked you to do what you're doing? But the point is that we need both. In order for a healthy society, we need both the artists and the so-called workers.
And the artists need to be compensated for what they do.
Which is what Chris Raschke says. We just want the same respect the plumbers get.
That Chris being the illustrator again for the book. And so the jury takes the question up, and the jury, of course, being Timothy Termite, Lisa Cricket, I think the alternates were Billy Flea and Michael Mosquito. They take this up with Barry Beaver and Sidney Fox and the rest
sure.
of them.
And I gave Barry Beaver, by the way, and that was very important because Robin, 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 and Wren had sued the beavers when they were illegally damming up the creek upstream and changing the water tables. So Barry's family had a quarrel with the law firm. They decided to let Barry be on the jury because they thought if we have a good case, he's going to do the right thing, that people are honest, that we don't have to stack the jury.
Backstory there.
Yeah.
The trial. The book is a lot of fun, but it also has teachable moments.
My mom was a third grade teacher. I'm smiling. I hope you can hear my smile.
Yeah.
My mom was a third grade teacher, and mommy always loves these kind of stories. So when I started to sort of take up children's literature, because young people need to hear stories, I think, about heroes, and they need to see alternatives to even older stories that we know, like Aesop. It was time somebody brought him up to date. My mom would have just absolutely adored being a recipient of a book like this. I would have actually dedicated it to Mommy. I dedicated it to Grandpapa.
And Uncle Remus and Aunt Jemima.
Sure. All of the good storytellers, and they all are.
Is part of the book's goal, maybe sort of a Trojan horse kind of thing. You get young kids reading this, and then they'll grow up thinking about arts funding and, you know, being more, you know, aware of these issues.
I hadn't thought about it that way. I just thought that kids look at so much television that has so much violence,
yeah.
And maybe they should see that everything doesn't have to be settled violently. We can settle it the American way. We can sue, that the law is there to protect the weak as well as to temper the strong, and that our system is a workable system, and that we have faith that the people would make a good and a proper judgment.
That's poet and author Nikki Giovanni. Her new book is The Grasshopper's Song. Nikki, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you.